much of this quantity of news that we get is what I call junk food news, the O.J. Simpsons, the Clinton, Monica Lewinsky stuff.
Journalists who work within the corporate media are working in a media industry that has about as much to do with independent journalism as Safeway has to do with family farming.
The ethics of the chief of staff of the president of the United States outing the wife of a ambassador whose report they didn't like is ethically abominable.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, October 8th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Relying on an 89-year-old statute, Californians voted yesterday to oust Democratic Governor Gray Davis by a margin of 55% to 45% and replace him with an actor and political novice, Arnold Schwarzenegger. With 99% of the votes counted, Schwarzenegger stands as the winner of the recall election. The official count has until November 5th to be certified, and 2.2 million absentee ballots were cast. U.S. Representative John Conyers, a Democrat, spoke with Peace Watch today about the extraordinary political turnabout and whether having a Republican in the governor's mansion in California could spell trouble with a big T for Democrats in the upcoming presidential race for the White House.
The reason that I think it is because there is a direct link between President George Bush and Arnold Schwarzenegger. They were both exceedingly careful not to mention each other's name during his campaign. Because if Schwarzenegger had mentioned Bush, then all the kids that thought this was a great cinematic political exercise would have been turned off immediately.
What is the link between the two?
The link between the two is Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to try to take California out of the Democratic column on November 2nd, 2004.
Well, the exit polls show that about 30% of the Democrats voted for Schwarzenegger, as well as 42% of women, despite the allegation of sexual misconduct. I mean, there are some Democrats that are obviously willing to vote for him, so part of the job's already done.
Well, I don't know if the job is done yet or not. I mean, voting for Schwarzenegger doesn't automatically mean that you're voting for Bush. But Schwarzenegger winning over Davis means that Bush's chances of carrying California are increased. I don't think we can conclude, therefore, that Bush wins California because Schwarzenegger won an incredibly truncated recall from a law in 1911 that's never been used before in a special election in which 40% of the precincts were contracted.
But you do think, Congressman, that this increases the GOP's
Absolutely.
Chances?
There's little doubt about it.
Congressman, yesterday you wrote a letter to senior White House advisor Karl Rove asking him to resign for his alleged efforts to push classified information to reporters regarding the name and status of Ambassador Joseph Wilson's wife. Mm-hmm. And your letter says the law states that even if you lawfully knew Mr. Wilson's wife's status as a covert CIA operative, you were obliged to come forward and report the press leak to the proper authorities, not inflame the situation by encouraging further dissemination. Precisely what laws has Karl Rove broken, and what is the possibility, in your opinion, that he will actually take your advice and resign?
First of all, the laws that he has broken are found in Title 18 United States Code, annotated, Section 793 at two places, a law that I am not unfamiliar with, which requires anybody that leaks information or contributes and passes on information is in violation of a federal statute that could get you up to 10 years in a selected federal prison. Not to mention that there could be other charges going from that, but this is a very serious violation of the law. Now, it's important that this violation of the law, which has already merited a criminal investigation by the Central Intelligence Agency and by the Department of Justice, be given an examination not by the Department of Justice, in which Ashcroft and Rove not only are friends, not only political partisans, but that one has reimbursed the other to the tune of $746,000 in several campaigns, which, if you didn't think there was a conflict before $750,000 had exchanged hands, I think you might think there is now.
So, Congressman, in your letter, you say that recent reports indicate that Karl Rove told the journalist Chris Matthews and perhaps others that Mr. Wilson's wife and her undercover status were fair game. Can you expound on that? Exactly what did he do?
That's what we're having an investigation for. I mean, I could call him and ask him to tell me the truth, but rather than do that, over and above the potential violations of the law, the ethics of the chief of staff of the president of the United States outing the wife of a ambassador whose report they didn't like is ethically abominable. That's why he ought to resign.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this thing is going to get pretty deep. If you read Newsweek, Time, and many others, we began to find out that it was pretty clear that this wasn't any kind of partisan activity. This thing was inside baseball in the White House somewhere.
So if Karl Rove opts not to resign, what legal recourse is there?
Well, we will still continue to press for an independent counsel. We think that John Ashcroft is particularly ill-suited to conduct a fair and impartial investigation in this matter. As a matter of fact, the law is pretty clear on what the requirements are about this, namely that there has to be a crime, there has to be a conflict of interest, and there has to be a public interest in the appointment of a special counsel. Well, the crime's already been determined, that the potential crime has already been determined by two groups. Is there a conflict? Well, if $746,000 exchanging hands between the person being investigated and the investigator isn't a conflict, then we'll have to rewrite the statute. Is there a public interest in appointing a special counsel? I can't imagine more than most of the citizens, an overwhelming majority of the citizens, that would support a special counsel, not my counsel, not a Democratic counsel, but someone not connected with the Department of Justice. Now, this has been the law and the tradition for decades. We either have a special counsel or we have an independent counsel. So this is the usual methods that we deal with, the White House being investigated and to prevent them from being investigated by themselves.
Congressman, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar. You made a reference to $746,000.
I did. When I refer to $746,000, I'm referring to the amount of money over three campaigns that Karl Rove was paid by John Ashcroft as a political consultant.
And so how much, what's your time frame, Congressman, for allowing the administration to come up with an independent counsel on this?
Well, I spoke to this on the floor last night. I will be speaking on it again. We will be building up the pressure. My understanding of the White House is that they frequently, when they don't want to do the right thing, if enough public pressure is brought to bear, then it will happen.
Any final thoughts on your part, Congressman Conyers?
Well, I think that this is a continuation of the kind of activity that is coming out of a White House that started off talking about they wanted to bring integrity and honor to the White House. Remember those tremendous arguments that went on during the debate in which Bush was fed up with the kind of tactics and strategies that were being used in Washington. He was going to clean up Washington. He was coming from out of the political system and out of the beltway into here and clean it up. He's brought just the opposite, as a matter of fact. And I might like to connect the recount in Florida with the attempted redistricting in Texas with the trumped-up recall in California. Those are all purely blatant political acts that have only one thing in mind, to reduce the number of people of one party that are representing people in the government.
And I know that they still have to certify the results of the election last night in California, but you're suggesting that this, too, was part of some sort of GOP effort to disenfranchise a certain type of voter?
The person that started it all off was Darrell Issa, a congressman that works with me on the Judiciary Committee. He spent a cool $2 million soliciting $8 signature after having dug up this 1911 California law that had never been used before, which went to the point of not just a recall, but at the same time, without knowing that a recall had passed, and in a special election in which the election had just occurred 8 or 9 months ago, that we would immediately, you would immediately vote for what would happen if there were a recall without knowing if there was a recall. The panel, the special panel in the Ninth Federal Circuit said that this was not good for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that there were too many machines and balloting devices that were in violation of the law that we passed federally to eliminate the problems that occurred in Florida in November of 2000. The second reason, that there wasn't enough time between the elections for those corrections to be made. So here again we have a conservative court stepping in to say, in effect, that yes, we concede that there are ballots and machining devices that are not so hot in California, ironically, especially in Los Angeles County. But nobody's perfect. Let's go ahead with the election. Mm. And so they overrule their own panel.
And are you also referring to the fact that this one ballot entitled California to vote to recall Davis and to install a new person, whoever won, all in one fell swoop, so to speak?
Exactly. There's no precedent for that ever happening anywhere.
U.S. Congressman John Conyers, Dean of the Congressional Black Caucus and ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, yesterday called for the resignation of senior White House advisor Karl Rove.
Lies you tell.
Every year, a team of student researchers and faculty at Sonoma State University in California investigates news stories that are of great importance but receive generally little attention in the mainstream American media. The group calls itself Project Censored, and it just released its 2004 yearbook of what it deems to be the top 25 most relevant yet underreported stories of the past year. An awards ceremony was held last weekend, co-hosted by Pacifica's Dennis Bernstein and Larry Binsky, and broadcast live on Free Speech TV. We're going to bring you some of the sound from that event on today and tomorrow's show, but we want to start with this conversation with Project Censored co-founder Peter Phillips.
For starters, can you tell us a little bit about what led you to conceive the idea of Project Censored, where it came from?
It was summer of 1976, and I was developing preps for classes in sociology for the following fall and spring. And at the same time, I was 76 was just a few years after the 72 elections with Nixon and all that, and I was perplexed. I couldn't understand how in June 1972, Richard Nixon could be elected by a landslide 5 or 6 months after the biggest political crime in history, Watergate, in June of 1972. So I went back and I started checking out the media, and I discovered that Watergate was not a story in 1972. Watergate would not become a big story until well into 1973, months after the election. The people did not have the information they needed about Watergate when it would have paid off for them before going to the polls. Okay. So I started checking around. I discovered, wow, there are a lot of other stories that are really important and hit issues that are important to people and all the rest that aren't get the coverage they deserve. And that was the genesis of then Project Censored. When I first started the project, I often got asked about, why do I call it censored? Why is it censorship? There is no such thing in the United States as censored news. And I would say, well, yes, there is. And I would try to defend myself on it. And they would say, well, Carl, the problem is that you're an academic egghead and that you want your kind of news covered in that 30 seconds that we have, but we are the ones that are responsible, and we're the ones that have to figure out what is best for that news spot there, what is best for that hole in the media there to go in there that for the people need to know. And so I said, well, that's a reasonable argument, as a matter of fact. And so absolutely. I said, I just about to check what they're filling that expensive, hard-to-fill hole with. And that's when I came up with the concept of junk food news. And I discovered that much of this quantity of news that we get is what I call junk food news, the O.J. Simpsons, the Paul Apprentices, the Clinton, Monica Lewinsky stuff, all of that stuff, what I call junk food news. And that's the quantity of news I'm talking about that we've been given as a public. And unfortunately, we get used to it as a public. And so when the media go out and do their interviews as to what do you like to see, the public play back what they've been seeing.
Hello, I'm Jason Spencer, and I co-authored Chapter 3 in this year's Censored 2004 yearbook, Junk Food News and News Abuse. Why does the media spend so much time on junk food news? It's one of those things that's easy to do. It's profitable. It doesn't take any time and energy to research. It doesn't take sending a reporter out into the field to do any true investigative journalism. That's the expensive part of journalism, the investigative journalism, the true research that goes into telling people what they need to know to be proactive citizens. Junk food news doesn't take any of that. It's easy. It's right there. It comes right out of Hollywood. It comes right off of the television commercials. It's in their lap. News abuse stories that we saw this year were a little more serious. And that's the thing with news abuse. They are real news stories. They're things that need to be covered, that the American people may need to know about. But when they dominate the airwaves for an excessive amount of time, that's when they become a problem. The sniper in Washington, D.C. last summer, that was something that needed to be talked about. The American public needed to know. It might even be considered a news event, but it didn't need to dominate the news the way that it did. The Lacey Peterson abduction in California, that was a story. It definitely was newsworthy. Did it need to be on the news every night? When we didn't have any updates on the case, did we need the pundits telling us maybe the husband was involved, maybe he wasn't? We don't think that was necessary. That's when it becomes news abuse, when other stories that are important to the American public are crowded out. One of the problems that we see with junk food news and news abuse in the American media is that it instills fear in the American public. The anthrax story, for example, it definitely scared the American public and it diverted their attention. While there were things going on in Congress and things going on Capitol Hill at the time that the American people needed to know about, now as the discussion begins about the Patriot Act, the American public is fairly ignorant of what went on, what that act actually says. That is what the news media should have been telling us about at the time. While we were being scared and diverted from the true story while they were talking about anthrax, the real story that the American public needed to know. Again, in order to make those responsible civic decisions, they were not privy to the information that they needed, thanks to the American mainstream media.
My research story number 11, which is the U.S. implicated in the Taliban massacre. The story is essentially about a documentary that was done by Jamie Doran, who is a Scottish film producer, and it's video evidence and interviews with witnesses about the U.S. involvement in a mass killing of 3,000 Taliban prisoners. And the evidence was brought to the Pentagon, and the Pentagon denied that any U.S. troops were involved in it, but they were stationed at Shebargan prison, and the Northern Alliance even said they were there. So either they were there and just ignored it, or they were actually involved in it.
Student researcher for Project Censor, and I worked on story number 16, Plan Puebla Panama and the FTAA. Basically what the story is about is President Vicente Fox from Mexico is working with the FTAA to kind of build this plan, Panama, to just allow multinational corporations go in there, kick the indigenous people off their land, use all the natural resources. Basically the corporations are going to go in there, build railroads, roads, things to make it easy, because then they're going to have factories that are going to allow the people to work pretty much in like sweatshop type jobs to compete with China, so they can export goods from China cheaper that way, build them in those factories in Panama, and then be able to ship them all around, you know, the major market in the Atlantic and the U.S. for a lot cheaper than it would normally cost them. I really enjoyed working with Project Censor. I had never heard about it until I took Peter Phillips' class. And it's just, it amazed me of how much stuff I didn't know, how much stuff that's not put out in the media, and how we're just kind of, you know, we go along with what's on those media channels, and we really don't know what's happening on in our world. And it kind of makes us blind to everyone else's problems.
I'm an intern with Project Censored. I've been here a couple of years, and we're a media research group here at Sonoma State University. And what we do as interns with Project Censored is we research independent or alternative media just to see what kinds of stories are being left out of the mainstream press, what they're ignoring. The kind of media that we research is newspapers, websites, magazines that are not owned by corporations. For instance, media like ABC, CBS, they're part of a corporate system where ABC being owned by Disney or CBS being owned by Viacom, that's more of a big business style. They answer to the shareholders and to the bottom line. Independent media, for example, Mother Jones, The Nation, some of the magazines that we look at, newspapers like Asheville Global Report. We do a lot of online internet research as well, Alternet, CommonDreams.org, those kinds of media is what we research. Now, independent media, nonprofit media, is important, I believe, for the reason that it gives a different viewpoint than what we see in the mainstream press. Difference of perspective, you see, especially with the foreign press, you get a perspective that's outside of the U.S. big business media. And I think that's very, very important to stay informed, especially with world events, because we get a very homogenized view from the corporate media in the United States.
Now, we have student interns that research the news stories year-round. So there are anywhere over 100 students participate in any given book cycle. And they will read independent news magazines from all over the world, from all over the U.S., from all over for foreign press, and look for important news stories that are deemed that the American people should know about, stories that impact our lives, stories that tell us, you know, why wages have been kind of spiraling downwards and why health care costs so much in the country, and things that affect us on a personal basis, our daily life, and decisions that powerful people are making that influence us. Those stories are copied and forwarded to experts in the field. We have someone from every department at Sonoma State University in all the disciplines. So if the story's on nuclear energy, then the physicist will read the story. If it's on religion, then maybe a person who specializes in philosophy of religion or sociology of religion will review and evaluate those stories. And each year, several hundred stories are processed and rated by our faculty experts and community experts. We have doctors, lawyers, a rabbi. These people evaluate the stories and screen them initially, and they're rating them on how important is this story for the American people to know, And how credible is this story? Does this story have validity? Has it been well researched? So that process occurs. We narrow it down to about 200 stories each year. Then the students will research those to determine, through using NexusLexis, ProQuest, and Dow Jones, the degrees to which those stories have been covered in the U.S. The story's on the front page of the New York Times, then it's not going to be in the censored book because people had a chance to read it. But very often we're finding very important news stories that have had zero coverage in the United States, that simply have not been covered here. And those are the ones that get forwarded to the final selection process. And we'll narrow it down to the top 50 stories, then all the faculty here, the evaluators, and all the students that have been associated with the program vote on those top stories, and that's the initial ranking. And then the top 25 as a group are sent out to our national judges, who are scholars, media experts all over the country, and they help rank the story. So that's how we end up with a 1 through 25 ranking that comes out every year in the book. And it's saying to the public that the corporate media is not completely fulfilling their role in terms of keeping us informed in a democratic society.
Peter Phillips is the founder of Project Censored at Sonoma State University in California. His group of faculty and student researchers has just released its book of the top 25 most censored news stories of 2003. That documentary was produced by Dan Bluehart and Joshua Travers. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.